Okay, good morning everyone. This is the Narkees Bible study. Today is the 7th of June, in the year of our Lord, 2014. I'm John Belts, and I'm going to be doing our Bible study today. Some of you know me, some of you don't, that's okay. Today we're going to be talking a little bit about, this has been done a little bit before, a few months ago. Sharon did something similar to this. I'm going to try and move a little bit more in depth today. We're going to talk about some of the Old Testament law that we find in Exodus and law that we find in the ancient Near East, specifically the law codes of Hammurabi and Eshnunna. Now, I'll explain a little bit more about what those are. First, let me just deal with the question of why should we care about this so that we all actually want to learn more about it. Many times when we as 21st century people read the law codes in the Old Testament, they don't quite make sense to us. You know, if I read the law about the goring ox, I can say, okay, this is great. I would know what to do if I had an ox that gored, but I don't own an ox. So isn't this just irrelevant to me? Which is probably the wrong way to go about it. The wrong way to go about it is to compare the laws that we find in the Bible to what we expect laws to be like today. You'll find this a lot of times if you ever read books by certain atheist authors. They very frequently like to point to laws in the Pentateuch, in the Torah, and say, oh, look at this, how could a good God command this or that? You know, there's laws about, you know, if you beat a slave and the slave gets up the next day, then there's no penalty on you. And they'll point to that and they'll say, look how terrible this is, how could a good God make a law like that? So what I want to do today is to compare the laws that we find in Exodus. We're specifically going to look at Exodus today. I think we'll touch on Numbers once, maybe. And compare it to other laws that were in other cities and other countries in the same time period, and actually the time period before that. So by doing that, we can get a good context for what these laws are doing and how they're being understood. I think when the Israelites are standing at Mount Sinai and Moses comes down and he's reading off the laws to them, I don't think they were bewildered by it. I don't think they thought, that is so weird. Why does he not want us to boil a goat in its mother's milk? I think they understood enough because it was part of their culture that it just made sense to them. I think they probably thought, yeah, you know what? This is a really reasonable law code. I think we can agree to this. But for us as 21st century people from various parts of the world, a lot of these laws don't make quite as much sense. And so we actually have to go back. We have to find other laws from that time period in the world and try to understand them. And so what I want to do today, I'm just going to go over into a brief introduction to the two groups of law codes that we're going to be using today, the law code of Hammurabi and the laws of Eshnunna. And then I've got a couple different examples, and that's what the handout is. Sorry for those of you listening on the recorder, I gave them a handout. You don't get a handout. On the handout, I've given you some of the examples that we'll be looking at, and they're attached in the heading for each one is the corresponding parallel in Exodus. And so we'll work through some of those together, and what I want to try and do is discuss, and I want us to focus our discussion on both the similarities that we see and the differences, because we have to see both in order to really understand what's going on. We have to see the similarities to see what they would have been familiar with, when they heard Moses saying that God told them to do this, that they would have said, oh yeah, that makes sense, everybody does that. And also the things that are different, the things that they would say, oh, that's different, I like that, you know, or that's different, that's going to be interesting.
You just explained the title cuneiform source.
Yes, I should do that. The law codes that we'll be looking at today, most of the law codes that we have from the ancient Near East are written in languages that use a cuneiform script, which is a type of script which was designed to be written on specifically clay and also stone. And it's basically, if you ever see it, it looks like little wedges, because they'd use sort of little triangular shaped stylus to sort of make it. Do we have a pen?
Right, an example.
Do we have a pen somewhere? Once we get a pen, I'll write an example down for you. So the reason I labeled it cuneiform sources is that all the law codes we're looking at are from cuneiform language, well, specifically Akkadian. But the languages written in that are sometimes just called cuneiform languages. It's Akkadian, Hittite, and Sumerian. And that's what I hope to focus in studying, which is why I'm talking about it, because I like to talk about things that I like. So I'll give you just a little bit of context to our two law codes. The Hammurabi law code. Well, you know what? I'll wait till we get our pen, and I can draw a little cool timeline on the board. The Hammurabi law code is a large sort of monolithic monument that was found. It was created, it's about this high. It's in the Louvre today. I've never seen it. I've just seen pictures of it. It was created on the orders of a Babylonian king named Hammurabi. Hammurabi was actually, he was not a native Mesopotamian. He was an Amorite, which means he was a West Semitic person who moved in a migration into Mesopotamia. He later became king. He was very much an expansionist, a real sort of type A kind of guy. There's letters that he's written where he's very angry with people for not doing what he wants them to do. And he conquered a lot of people. And later in his life, he had this giant stele, this giant monument made, and it had this huge inscription on it, which was all of these laws. And it starts off with this introduction about how the sun god Shamash, you know, told him to establish justice on the earth. And so the law code is King Hammurabi's justice. And there's different people have suggested different understandings of it. Initially, people thought, this is a law code that, like we find in the Bible. This is, oh, thank you so much. This is these are laws that were written down that people would follow. They would cite it like it was, like they were precedents. Later on, people thought, you know what? Maybe they're not so much precedents, but examples of how Hammurabi established justice, because they're very all over the place. It's not systematic. And this law code was very, very influential. It was during a war between the Babylonians and the Elamites. When the Elamites were victorious, at one point they actually stole the stele of Hammurabi from the city of Babylon, and they carted it off to their capital in Susa, which is actually where archaeologists found it.
What's the name of this thing? A stele?
Stele. It's just... It's a
pillar of some sort.
Yeah. I forget if it's two L's or one L, but... just basically means a...
One L and a V.
One L and a V. Okay. Thanks. Glad you guys know my subject code tonight. It's everyone's vocabulary word for today. Try to use it in a sentence at some point.
Don't steal that word.
It basically, a stele is just a giant stone, typically stone monument that has writing on it. That's what a stele is. So, later points when we excavated scribal schools, like places where scribes were trained, we find examples where the scribal students had to write out in cuneiform. They were writing out some of these laws. So it seems to be part of like the scribal curriculum. You know, you go to school today. Well, maybe not today, but in the past, you know, you'd go to school and you'd learn Shakespeare, or you would learn, you would learn the Bible, or you would learn, whatever. There's certain things that are part of what an educated person is supposed to know in various cultures. And in Mesopotamian cultures, an educated scribe would know laws from Hammurabi. You want me to draw out some cuneiform. So I'll just write out, this is something that's going to come up a couple times today. Emmanuel, you can correct me because I might get some of this wrong. My wedges look really bad. I'm sorry about that.
We're steel on that last word.
Yeah.
What does this say? Ordering at McDonald's.
They milk two shizzes.
Oh, they milk two shizzes.
You're deciphering now.
You translated that, right?
Yeah.
This is, you can read this, right, Daniel?
That's
Shuma Awilu. Shuma Awilu. This is how most of the laws in the Code of Hammurabi start. This is Shum. The cuneiform languages are typically written syllabically. It's not an alphabet like we use or like Hebrew and Arabic use today. It's written in syllables. So this is the syllable Shum, Ma, A, We, Lum. And it's the way the Lokat Hammurabi, most of the laws start. And it means if a man, and then after that we would get an action of what the man does, and then after that we would get a statement about what we should then do with that man who's done that. Typically kill them, as we'll see. The Law Code of Hammurabi is known for being incredibly severe, especially with punishments, as we'll see, involving stolen property or things like that. It frequently has death penalties carried out by means of beating, drowning, burning, throwing down from a high tower, and even throwing in a river, etc. Although it's probable that some of those harsh punishments were not always carried out, but again, they were probably examples of times where Hammurabi established justice. A certain case happened, and he said, fine, throw that guy off the tower. And so they did, and that was justice. The law code of Eshnunna is slightly older. In fact, there's debates about it may have been an influence on Hammurabi when he wrote his code.
Could you give us the rough date for?
Oh, that's right. I have a little timeline. Mm. Let me just draw that real quick. Okay, I'm gonna have to erase my cool cuneiform because I wrote it really big. That's okay. Use the word "steal" in a sentence for the end of the day. Here's year zero. Let's put 1,000. Oh, I need more than this. It's 2,000 from BC. See. We're going to put the writing of most of the Hebrew Bible here. The covenant at Sinai, we're going to put approximately here. So this is when the laws are given. This is our manuscripts of when we have recorded in the Bible. And then we're going to put Hammurabi somewhere in here and Eshnunna somewhere in here. I'm using circles because this is just really sort of rough approximate.
The ones around 1,000, the one after, that's the giving of the law there.
Yeah, we're going to write Sinai.
All right, thanks. Sorry to be so dim.
No, that's fine. I need to make my graph more coherent.
Hebrew scriptures.
Where's Job on that timeline? Where's
Job? Job is a big debate, which I'm not going to get into right now. Some people say it's very early. Some people say it's very late. Some people say it could be a story which is very early, which is written down very late. It's a big, very complicated, sticky issue.
What's the earliest they think?
I don't know.
Okay.
And I'm going to not go into it because we need to stick to engineers and law.
Yeah, and Eshnunna all the way later.
Yeah, the names are spelled on your handout if you need them. And I've also written them here. Sometimes you'll find Hammurabi's name spelled with a B, Hammurabi. And that's there's again, there's a debate about that, because the cuneiform sign, which is used for the B and the P, is the same sign. So again, big debate, won't go into it right now, it's a very linguistic debate.
And would it be a fair comment to say that those two are about the same time as Abraham?
Yeah, we could say that.
Yeah.
Maybe slightly before. Mm-hmm. But around approximately the same time. If for approximate dates, that is helpful. Hammurabi himself ruled specifically from 1792 BC to 1750 BC. So if you want some more specific dates, I'll put it here. And read his name's Ham, because I'm sort of writing the whole thing out. Does it say 1792 to 1750?
So it's after Abraham.
It depends when you date Abraham. About approximately the same time. The laws of Ishnuna, like I said, were slightly before. They were the laws which we have a couple different copies of, which were written down and probably enforced in a city called Ishnuna, which is on the Tigris River today in modern day Iraq. The city was later conquered by Hammurabi, which may be where he got the idea to write the law code. That's all I'm going to say on that, I think. So what I want us to do now, let's take a look at the very first... Let me pull up the handout because I have it on here. Okay, so the very first thing we're going to look at is the concept measure for measure. Or midah keneged midah, just in Hebrew. Exodus 21, 23, 25. If anybody wants to read that for us, just shout it out, somebody.
If, however, he survives a day or two, am I right? Exodus 21, 23, 25, sorry. But if there is any further injury, then you shall appoint as a penalty life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise.
Yes. So that... Do we have another paper copy of the handout, by the way?
This one.
Oh, so I have it on here, but
that's right.
Paper's easier.
Paper.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, Danny. Okay. Okay. So, we also see that there's a similar concept in the law code of Hammurabi. If a man blinds the eye of a man, they shall blind his eye. Here we see the same, if a man, shuma wilum, again. If he breaks the bone of a man, they shall break his bone. If a man knock out the tooth of a man, his rank, they shall knock out his tooth. And here's one thing we can see, which is maybe a slight difference that some people have noticed, is that there's different punishments for different strata of people, different social layers of people within the law code of Hammurabi. And we don't find that quite as much in the Hebrew Bible. We do find a distinction sometimes between slaves and normal people, or between Israelites sometimes and foreigners, not so much in this code, but in some other ones. Sometimes women, and I think in the goring ox one, I think there's something about if it's a younger person. But typically, we don't find this social stratification quite as much. The biblical law code is much more egalitarian, we could say. We have different... I should have written them down for myself, so I remember. There's three different levels mentioned in the Hammurabi law code. There's the Awilum, which is literally a man. People think it's probably like a free man, although again, definitions, I'm not quite sure what that is. There's the Mushkenum, which I translated on our sheet here, I translated it as bondsman, but it's really debated about what that means exactly. It's some sort of person who's dependent, probably someone who works the palace lands or something. Palaces and temples, mostly temples, control most of the land in a Mesopotamian city. Mesopotamian cities were thought of as the estate of a god. So if the god, like the god of Babylon, was Marduk. And so if you lived in Babylon, you were living on Marduk's estate. And if you were a farmer, you were simply, it was like you were a farmhand working for Marduk. And you would work one of his fields for him.
My God.
So that could be what this is.
That is so powerful.
And what would happen is the grain would come in, products would come into the temple, and then they would be redistributed again to the people. So it's been compared, probably slightly unfairly, to a form of socialism. Like I say, slightly unfairly. And then the third category of people is the wardum, which is a slave. Someone who is technically owned by somebody else. Usually either captives in warfare or people who would go into like a type of debt slavery, like most college students and grad students today. Just throwing that out. So this is one difference. Again, we saw the similarity that both law codes, both Exodus and the law code of Hammurabi in this case, have the idea that punishment should be equal, especially for personal injuries. You know, if I get mad at somebody and I punch them and knock their tooth out, then the judge should say, okay, John, we need to knock your tooth out now. But again, there's more that I didn't put on here. I have the one about the man knock out the tooth of the man his own rank, they should knock out his tooth. And there's other ones after that. If he knock out the tooth of a free man, if he knocks out the tooth of a slave, if he knocks out the, and so on. And they all have slightly different penalties. So, anybody have any questions relating to this topic?
I keep having to. What is it? You put out the eye of a blind man, and the whole world goes blind.
An eye for an eye makes the
world. An eye for an eye. Yeah. An eye for an eye makes. Who said that?
Gandhi.
That was Gandhi.
Yeah. A little bit out of our historical period that we're.
Yeah, just a trifle. But I'm trying to see. So Gandhi said it. The scripture doesn't say it, does it, though? No. Doesn't say an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, or does it?
Well, it just did in the passage we just read.
Yeah. Concept of the maximum penalty.
Mm. That's one another thing that's been looked at, too. Some people have compared it to. Typically in a lot of traditional cultures, especially here in the Middle East, especially in, well, any nomadic culture you find around the world, and people have studied specifically Bedouin culture, is that you can, the concept of a blood feud, you know, if somebody does something to our clan, we do the equivalent to their clan. But there are laws, even within like Bedouin oral law, there are certain things. If I'm a Bedouin and somebody kills a member of my clan, if I were to go and kill five members of their clan, all the other Bedouin tribes would say, that's not good, that's wrong. And so that's, in a sense, it's very similar. This provides a, not necessarily a necessity, but something that. That is a limiting factor. You know, you can't say, he knocked out my tooth, I want him to pay this amount of money. He knocked out my tooth, I want him to, you know, I want somebody to break his knees. Like, you can't do that. Like, it sets a standard. Certainly, I think somebody could probably forgive someone for knocking their tooth out. Like, it's not a big problem. I, you know, insulted his mother or something like that. I shouldn't have done that. You know, I deserved it. But, so yeah, that's another way of looking at it.
So the Bible is putting a limit on revenge, in a sense, more so than Hammurabi.
You can read it like that. Neither of the law codes. I think what it says here again. Let me just check the Exodus one. 23.
And I'm.
It doesn't say this must happen, but it does say this is in the Bible. This is sort of a follow-on from the law about when two men are fighting, and if in their ensuing, you know, shoving match, you know, somehow a woman gets hurt and she's pregnant and she has a miscarriage. But a bit, you know, and it says what to do in certain cases about that, and then it says if there's any additional damage in terms of personal fighting or combat, then, you know, this is how you should deal with it, or this is how you could deal with it. I don't know quite how. In Hammurabi, it simply just says, if a man blinds the eye of a man, they shall blind his eye. That's simply literally how it is.
You mentioned at the beginning that Hammurabi was, you know, idol worshiper, and his god is Shemesh. So he wrote his code could be under the influence of a certain god, you know. But my question is, did God dealt with mankind before him? I mean Abraham, we know that Abraham is before Hammurabi. He left Ur, and, you know.
Well, we're not given a date for Abraham specifically.
We're not giving a date, but it's, you know, books of history affirm that Abraham was around 1800 or more, or even more, about 2000 years before Christ. So we see that the true God influenced Abraham and dealt with him and gave him the true code, you know, law code, which includes, this is, Hammurabi is a moral code. It has nothing to do with sacrifices and, you know, prophecies like Abraham knew about that.
This is true, but the law code that we're looking at in Exodus also does not mention sacrifices.
Well,
that would be Leviticus.
Well, I believe that all this Hammurabi law is can summed up with the six commandments out, you know, not the first four dealt with relation with God, and the other six dealt relation with other people. So this is the moral code, you know, which is given by God, but no mention of the true God. So I believe, you know, it comes to my mind that everything God do, the devil always try to copy that and influence other people. That's why we see people worship frogs, and, you know,
it's possible. The problem with that is that the laws are said to not, were not given before Sinai.
But we know that Abraham was following
Abraham was
this
not
law.
Given the law.
Even it is
it
not,
never says that.
It is not coded,
not,
you know. On Sinai, the code was coded. I mean, written on stone and on books by Moses. But we know that Abraham and, you know, the fathers, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, were following the true God, you know.
But the issue...
Even the prophecy about Jesus' sacrifice is the true, the story of Abraham giving Isaac on Mount Moriah here. So the true
but
God
that's
is...
That's different than the law code that we're looking at.
Would you like
for me to
read Exodus 21:16?
The question.
Yeah, this will be an interesting issue. We're going to move on though. We're going to go on to the next one.
Okay.
So yeah, you can read
if it's not in, if it's not
Exodus.
Hang on, guys. We're moving on.
Exodus 21:15. Not word of God.
Says anyone who attacks his father or his mother must be put to death.
This is all moral.
Okay, and anybody want to read Law Code of Hammurabi? Emmanuel, read first Law Code of Hammurabi.
Okay. If a son strikes his father, they shall cut off his hand. So
So what do we see? I'll put the question out to you guys. What do we see that's similar?
Striking of parents.
Mm-hmm. Well?
Also honoring the parents.
Mm-hmm. And what's different?
Well, one is put to death and the other one is cut off his hand.
Mm-hmm. One is just the father and the other is father and the mother.
Exactly. That's another interesting one too. It was funny, I didn't actually see that until I was reading some different other secondary literature about this, and one of the books mentioned it, and I was like, oh yeah, I didn't realize that. So there's on first glance we might say, wow, this biblical law is a lot harsher than the law code of Hammurabi. But again, I think we see two things out of this. First, we see the law code of Hammurabi is more is concerned with the patriarchal authority, not necessarily with respect for elders in general, or with specifically with both parents. And secondly, I think again that it does show the severity of disrespect for elders.
Which gets reflected, I guess, in the Ten Commandments, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And that's the only... they say that, you know, the honor your father and mother is the one that's connected to a blessing. So.
Right.
Well, there is mercy there, the Ten Commandments. But Hammurabi is kill.
Yes, but...
Well, listen, here's the other way around.
His study is on Hammurabi. His whole job at the moment is to explain to us all the differences. So all the ties up that you have, we just leave for a bit and let John go on, because it's really important what he's doing.
I just ask a question.
So anybody else have any other thoughts on this? Anything else that you notice? That
there is something more important.
That the woman, I had read something that in the cultures where you have the Bible as the foundation for moral law or whatever, you see more. I think Sharon had mentioned this, more of a respect for life, for the life itself, and obviously the women.
There's a very amazing book which I read recently, and I forget its name, about an Indian Christian who basically says that, and it's talking about the work of the missionaries in India in the last century, the last two centuries. And it's talking about the whole way culture has changed in terms of respect for women, and respect for the elders, the education of kids, and of course medicine and the law and everything. And I think Emmanuel would say the same sort of thing in Nigeria. Once you've got the Bible as a basic text, the whole community changes.
Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, one of the important things that I see in this kind of study. Is it lets us see, I would call it the change in trajectory in terms of legal understandings. So if, for example, this line here, again, sorry those of you who are listening on the recorder because you won't be able to see this. Oh no, my marker's dying.
You can't see either.
Yeah, you guys can't see either. If this is just sort of, we'll just call this this law in general, this is just sort of its movement, this is where it is going, maybe it's going somewhere, maybe it's just moving through the same iterations over and over again. What we see here, again, sorry, this is really, really faint. What we see here is that with the covenant at Sinai, we get a bit of a difference here, we get a bit of an angle. And I'm not good at math. I liked geometry. I didn't like algebra. One thing I remember from geometry is that, okay, so the degree of this angle is the same, but the distance of this angle is much smaller than it is here. This distance is greater than this distance. So if this is what we find in OT law, this type of distance between, if you want, like, normal, the way that humans, the surrounding cultures, we see a bit of difference. If we follow those changes out, like this one, the addition of one word, the name, I think it is. One word in Hebrew, yeah, the emo. And his mother, or his mother. The addition of that one word, the small change, that we get, in addition with other things, eventually leads us today, where we have a much greater understanding of, for example, rights for women, and so forth. So I think that's an important. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Very much.
I realize I'm just kind of not coherent there, but yeah. So this is the way I like to see a lot of this, is to try to find where these subtle differences are that get us off of this path and put us on a trajectory that gets us to a lot of where we are today. So let's move on with that to the next one. Let's even more differences. Let's move on to stolen property. Somebody want to read for us Exodus 21:37?
Yeah,
there's no 37. Oh, there is no 37? Maybe it's the difference.
It's 22:1, I think.
Okay, yeah, 22:21 in some editions. That's the Hebrew verse in nation. It's a little different in some places. So 22:1.
A fine must be paid for anyone who steals an ox or sheep and then kills or sells it. For oxen, the fine is 5 oxen for each one stolen, and for sheep, the fine is 4 sheep for each one stolen.
Okay.
What version is that? 22:1.
The Understanding One. New Living.
Oh, nice. Oh yeah, I've got 5 headed. Sorry, Dawn.
The numbers were right.
Okay, and then somebody, this is, again, the verse nation is probably off. If you skip the part about the tunneling thief, because we're going to come back to that later, and there's in what is in the Hebrew verse nation 22:2, which I think
is a thief
in the English.
4:5, if what he stole is actually found alive in his possession, whether an ox or a donkey or a sheep, he shall pay double.
Yeah. Okay. Wait. Skip ahead to in your English versions.
This is what Claire's just right.
Oh, okay, yeah.
She's Claire's just right.
Yeah, but include 3b as well. Anyone who steals must make restitution.
Anyone who steals must certainly make restitution, but if they've nothing, they must be sold to pay for their theft. If the stolen animal is found alive in their possession, whether ox or donkey or sheep, they must pay back double.
Okay. Now I'll read. Let's see what Hammurabi has to say on the same issue. If a man steals a bull, sheep, donkey, pig, or boat, I know, I looked up the word, it's apparently boat, I have no idea what the connection is. Actually, no, I think I do. I'll come to that later. If it is from a god or the palace, he will give 30-fold. If from a bondsman, use that word again, which we don't really know what it is, one of these social levels, he will recompense 10-fold. If the thief does not have anything to give, he shall be killed.
His life doesn't matter much, does it?
Yeah, that's one of the... Well, let's start with the similarities. What are the similarities?
There has to be restitution.
Restitution has to be made in addition to what you've stolen. Mm-hmm. You know, you steal one ox, you have to pay more than one ox. Mm-hmm. That's a similar thing. The differences. This one has some great differences.
Yeah, there's a level.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And between how much should be paid to who, ever.
Right. We have a difference in social structure. And also, if you steal from the god or the palace, which is essentially the governing institutions, if you steal from the government, you have to pay 30-fold. If you steal from Joe Schmo down the street, you pay 10-fold.
Sounds like the IRS.
Yeah. It's the government looking out for its interests more than people's interests, which, as an American, I'm like, that's wrong. But
hey, John, there's a story even today of the Jewish stories where a man ends up finding that his donkey's gone, and word has it that a certain person up the street has stolen his donkey. So the donkey, he goes up and knocks on the door, and he says, I hear that you stole my donkey. And he says, how could you possibly say that about me? In the background, the donkey brays, and he's, he says, what are you going to do, believe him or believe me?
Exactly. And then the other big difference that we see in this one, which again was mentioned already, was that if the thief, in the Exodus text, if the thief can't pay, then you sell the thief. Again, this is a form of debt slavery. He can in theory eventually work that off. Mm-hmm. I say in theory. Again, talk to a grad student who has debt, and you'll find out otherwise. But
but you don't get killed.
Well, we don't get killed. That's true.
You don't get killed. I mean, you're doing very well.
Right, but again, you know, the thief can in theory. You know, if he maybe he was stealing, maybe he was stealing because, you know, because he was hungry. At least in debt slavery, he's being taken care of because the master is required to take care. Yes. Like slaves in this period are in a sense a part of one's extended family. So he's taken care of, and he again can in theory work off his debt and be free again.
Mm-hmm. Or he's so poor he's not going to have food to eat, he's going to die, so he might as well steal, because stealing is going to die anyway.
Exactly. Right.
He wants to live somehow.
Yeah.
And then the 30 and the 10 is not the same as the 3 and the 4.
This is true.
You know, the payment is a lot mm-hmm. more moderate in the Old Testament.
Incidentally, how long, or how, when am I supposed to stop?
22.
Oh man, I gotta hurry up. Okay. We still have to get through the tunneling thief and the goring bull, and then I have to share some final remarks. Let's go. Okay, tunneling thief. Again, we have different verse nation here. So, Exodus 22, verse 2, in your English versions. Again, I wrote down the Hebrew version on my handout.
If the thief is caught breaking in and is struck so that he dies, the defender is not guilty of bloodshed. But if it happens after sunrise, he's guilty of bloodshed.
Yes. And in Hammurabi, we find if a man breaches into a house, which is essentially he's digging into it. Like people lived in mostly mud-built houses in Mesopotamia. They don't have a lot of stone or metal or wood. They have some wood in Mesopotamia. What they had the most abundantly was clay and mud. So they built out of clay and mud. So you could dig into someone's house. So if a man breaches into a house, in front of that breach, they shall kill him and they shall hang him up. So essentially, they execute the criminal and then they mutilate the body by probably impaling it and leaving it there to be eaten by birds.
And also as a shock system to everybody else.
Exactly.
Not
it's a warning.
Not to try.
Don't try to steal because you will not only be killed, but everyone's going to watch your body decay.
Is this more along like the Muslim laws? You know, the Muslims, they have to be more radical on
that. I don't know. I haven't looked at a lot of Islamic law. These are all in the same sort of tradition of Middle Eastern traditional law. I don't know what the relationship is between the two. I haven't really looked into it. And I kind of want to just stick to Bible and Hammurabi right now, just because that's what I've studied. That's what those of us in the room are more familiar with, I think. But it's a good issue. It's a good question, though.
I suspect that you've got this tunneling going on, the specialist tools involved, which implies that the guy's a professional criminal.
That could be, too.
You know, it's not just stealing a loaf of bread because he's starving.
Right. Well, there's definitely premeditation there.
Mm.
I mean, any workman is likely to have some sort of tool that he can dig with in that culture. But yeah, there's a premeditation. It's not just, oh, I'm so hungry, there's some bread. You know, and steal the bread. You know, oh, I'm so hungry. There's a goat. Grab the goat. Run away with it. You know, this is like he's got to work at it.
It's not a petty theft.
Exactly. Another thing some people have pointed out is that tunneling at night, and this pertains to what in the Bible too, where we find at night it's permissible to kill the thief, in the daytime it's not. In many cultures like this, I tried to find an equivalent law for what to do if you catch a thief in the daytime breaking into a house in Hammurabi, because I read that one time and I couldn't find it. But it also involved killing the thief. That's all I remember. But one of the things that I think is interesting is that the reason that the penalty is probably harsher at night is because that's when people are in the house. In the daytime, mostly people are gone. You know, you might have somebody at home doing some routine chore, but if somebody breaks into a house in that culture, in the daytime, they're just going in to steal something. If someone breaks in at night, there's a very good chance they're coming in to kill you, mm-hmm. because they know you're home. So that's probably why the penalty is harsher at night. But again, we see in the biblical text, it is permissible to kill the thief in the middle of the night. Let's see what we have.
Well, even in isn't it permissible now to defend yourself? People have shotguns at night and they come down and they shoot intruders. Or is it just I've watched too much television?
I think the law wavers a bit because of there's been convictions if you've shot you've been convicted if you've shot an intruder.
Would I?
Well,
that's true. We turn the lights on. Hey, I know who you are now.
In the dark, it was dark.
Yeah.
The rules say call 9/11.
Yeah.
So anyway, like I said, we have to keep moving because apparently I'm running out of time. Okay.
The Goring Bill. Well, come, we've really got to get to him.
Yeah. Oh, hey, and we've got the. Sorry, one more quick thing. We have the law, a similar law from the Code of Eshnunna. A man who is seized in the house of a bondsman, in the house in broad daylight, shall weigh out 10 shekels of silver. He who is seized at night, he shall die. He shall not live. So again, we see the requirement that the person caught at night is killed, whereas it's the what we get from the biblical text is that if the thief is killed at night, it's not considered murder.
Yeah.
Because it's likely self-defense, but it does not require that the thief be killed. At least not that we can see. Okay, so the goring bull, last example. Somebody want to give me Exodus 21, 28 to 30? I think this is right in the verse submission.
If a bull gores a man or a woman to death, the bull must be stoned to death, and its meat must not be eaten, but the owner of the bull will not be held responsible. If, however, the bull has had the habit of goring, and the owner has been warned but has not kept it penned up, and it kills a man or woman, the bull must be stoned, and the owner also must be put to death. However, if payment is demanded of him, he may redeem his life by paying whatever is demanded. It keeps
is that
going
it?
On.
So I think that's probably good.
Okay.
We'll stop there. Somebody want to read what I have from Hammurabi?
If a bull, while it is walking in the street, gores a man and causes him to die, that case has no legal claim. But if the bull of a man is in the habit of goring and his municipality has informed him of the goring, and he has not trimmed or covered its horns, nor controlled, tied his bull, and that bull gores a person and causes their death, he shall pay half a mina of silver.
Yeah, one thing I didn't check was the amount that the measurements are, but I'm not sure that it matters too much for my purpose. And then somebody want to give me the last one, the Eshnunna paragraph?
If a bull was a gorer and the authorities have made it known to its owner, but he did not guard his bull and it gored a man and caused him to die, he should weigh out 15 shekels of silver.
Okay. 15 shekels is not a lot today. Back then it may have been more, but I can't even do a load of laundry for 15 shekels today. It's terrible. Okay. What do we see that's similar?
The line that the punishment always comes
if the owner knows that their bull is dangerous and has a tendency to attack people, and does nothing about it.
Exactly. Yeah. Differences. This one's got a lot of great differences.
Woman. A man or a woman.
Mm-hmm. We have that. Although the term that's used in the cuneiform text, in the Akkadian law codes, that if it gores a man, the term is mar wilim, son of a man, which is one of their terms. It's like ben adam in Hebrew, probably. It's a very generalized term for human being, like saying a member of mankind. Somebody might say it's a bit sexist, but it's still both genders. Big difference is that if the gore just out of nowhere gores someone in Hammurabi, there's no legal claim there. You can't do anything about it. It's like, well, I didn't know my bull was going to gore your son or daughter or, you know, your wife or whoever. Whereas the only time that there is legal penalty is when the bull has been known to do this before, and the authorities have told the owner of the bull, hey, keep your bull off the streets, or at least cut its horns off, you know, and he does. And then if he doesn't do that, in the biblical text we find that if the ox gores a man or woman to death, saying ox and bull are the same thing for our purposes here. The ox shall be stoned and its flesh shall not be eaten. Now again, we see that as, that sounds a bit more fair to us, because sure, a human being died, was killed by this bull. For them, I think, interestingly, one of the commentators I looked at mentioned this, he said that ancient people may have looked at that and thought that the biblical law was a bit unfair, because why should the owner of the bull have to suffer this terrible economic loss for something that he himself did not do? And yet I think it's to show the importance of human life, that human life is important.
In the Torah here, it's like a death penalty. It's possible to have a death penalty because of it.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That's another good point, is the fact that if the bull was known to gore, again, it wouldn't gore other people because then it would be killed, but if it gored other animals and the owner knew about it and it gores someone and kills them, then the owner is liable. The owner is liable for that person's life, and they have to do more than just pay whatever those amounts are of silver. The owner has that blood on their hands.
That's like shooting a rabid dog now.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like destroying a car that was in an accident that killed someone, even if there was nothing wrong with the car.
Right. It would be similar to that.
That's interesting. Yeah.
In one sense, we would look at it and we would say, oh, what a waste. The car was a perfectly good car. It wasn't dented up that bad. You know, the person's head didn't make that much of a dent in the fender. But at the same time, like,
it's a symbolic thing.
It's a symbolic thing that it killed a person. I mean, you know, sure. But
who's somebody's driving the car?
Exactly. Yeah, sure, you have a driver, but...
Well, he's also punished.
Right.
The Bible says that guy's going to be punished, and this car that has defiled human life.
Yeah.
So one has a responsibility for what one owns. If one has a car, and that car, even if it wasn't driven by you, it was driven by your kids, let's say, you end up losing the car, and that's your economic loss, in the same way as you didn't take care of your bull, and it may have been the bull who was the nasty bull, but he gets destroyed and you take the economic loss. It seems to be we do have a responsibility.
Right.
You know, if the person has a car, his brakes go out on his car when it's already known that his brakes were having problems.
Right. And he didn't take care of getting the brakes fixed.
Yeah.
And oh no, there's a pedestrian in the crosswalk. I can't stop.
There we go.
You know, is
the word mar in Aramaic a little bit later. Mm-hmm. Somebody who's of a kind of a status in society that is of like a landowner or somebody who's, you know, who were lower, more on the top.
Right. It's a little different, I think, than the Acadian.
But is the Acadian at least meaning somebody who has rights of citizenry?
It's semantically equivalent to Bain in Hebrew.
Right, but but I mean, it's kind of like
etymologically, it's
like
Gavra, but
Gavra and also in Hebrew,
right,
which is man, but it also means somebody who's a citizen.
Right.
And because of the figurative slave, it may not be the same punishment as...
Right, I think there might be a difference in ignoring of a slave. Anyway, I want to just share my concluding thoughts real quick, and then I'll let you guys go so that I don't get in trouble for keeping you too late. There was, to sum up some of the trends that we've seen, and this, I have to admit, is not my own observation. This is the observation from an article I read by Moshe Greenberg. He noted that one thing that's very interesting is that again, some of these laws do seem a bit, again, like the goring bull. It almost seems a bit harsh. And we didn't get to the. I was going to have us look at the biblical text on homicide, but there's you just look this up later. Numbers 35:31 has forbids. It says if you have a murderer, you can't not kill them. Forgive the double negative, but you must kill that person. You cannot accept a bribe if they say, "Oh, but I will, you know, give everything I have to the victim's family."
They can't redeem themselves.
You can't redeem themselves. In ancient Near Eastern law, that's a very common thing. A lot of the things that end in someone's death in these cuneiform laws tend to result in a person having to pay in economic restitution for the loss of the economic unit of the person. In the biblical law, there is a thing where the individual has intrinsic value, and destruction of the individual, you know, there's the part in Genesis, you know, he who spills the blood of a man by man, his blood shall be spilled.
Genesis 9.
Yeah, after the flood.
Mm-hmm.
Those kinds of things to show, like, this is so important. This is the one time that we will allow a person to be killed. Mm-hmm. Property.
What time is that? What time?
When a person is killed.
Please answer that.
I did.
You said
that. It's all right. You can listen to the recording. I have to finish up. So
I'll ask you after.
Yeah, you can ask me afterwards. Interestingly, though, the property loss, the property loss in cuneiform law is frequently death. It is never that case, or very, very, very rarely that case in biblical law. And Greenberg points out, he says that this is essentially what it does is it flips. It takes us from this economic view of human beings, that the value of a human life is what they could contribute economically, and the loss of a human life must be recompensed economically. That the loss of a human life is intrinsically something which must be paid for, is intrinsically valuable in and of itself. And whereas property, on the other hand, the cuneiform law codes, their emphasis on severe penalties for property loss have to do with just wanting everybody to just leave everybody else's stuff alone, you know, so badly that, you know, if you steal, we're just going to kill you, okay? If you try to break into someone's house, we're just going to kill you and impale your body in front of their house. In the biblical law, we say, look, property is important, yes, but it's not that important that we're going to just start killing people willy-nilly over it. And I think that, again, to go back to this poorly drawn chart that I have, you can't see because the ink is running out of this marker. That's one of those small differences that leads us to the larger differences we have today. The ideas we have of human rights, the ideas that we have of that human beings are not an economic commodity, that human beings are not an economic unit or utility. You're not just your economic value. You are intrinsically worth something. And that's
where this new value starts.
Exactly. But it's subtle. It starts with these small differences. We're not. It doesn't start by abolishing slavery. It says if you're going to have slaves, this is how you do it. This is how you do it. You keep the system functioning. It's not completely abolishing all of these things. It's changing them to the point that eventually they'll destroy themselves from the inside out. And on that,
I think it's very important because today in the Western world, maybe human life isn't valued as highly as it should be.
Mm-hmm. Well done, Joel.
Okay, Shabbat Shalom, everybody.
Shabbat Shalom.